Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today's guest has played variations of his signature dirtbag character on The League, Parks and Recreation, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. On Big Mouth, he plays a 12-year-old boy named Jay.
Now, there's someone very special I want you guys to meet.
Well, that's a pillow.
No. She's so much more than a pillow. Oof, Maron. Don't you want to just stick your dick in her?
Wait, what's that now?
Jay, do you fuck the pillow?
Yeah, my same question.
Oh, yeah, guys. I fuck my pillow. I'm sorry. My tone was off. Yes, I 100% fuck my pillow.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and this week I am joined by one of my all-time favorite comedic actors, Jason Mantzoukas. Like most comedy fans, I first took notice of Jason as Rafi on The League. But in the decade since that show first premiered, he has become an essential ingredient in countless shows and movies, perfecting a certain type of garbage human being who generally makes everything he's in a lot funnier. Remarkably, some of Jason's most nuanced work has come in Big Mouth, the animated show about puberty that premiered its fourth season this month on Netflix. We go deep on this episode about that performance and how he managed to put together one of the most consistently funny comedy careers of his generation. So let's get right to it. Here's me with Jason Mantzoukas. So have you been doing a lot of recording from your closet?
Yeah, you know, it really is. I'm very lucky that, you know, for a good portion of my workload, voiceover, animation, podcasts, etc., I'm able to do it from home. You know, they just sent me, you know, a better microphone and, you know, I had to download a couple of things. But yeah, for the most part, I've been very lucky that a lot of that work has been able to continue throughout this kind of miserable, you know, 9-10 month period.
Yeah. So I was just watching you the other day or yesterday on the guided meditation that Big Mouth hosted.
Oh yeah, were you there?
I was there for that. And so yeah, first of all, how'd you get roped into that? Was that a Netflix thing?
Kroll asked me to do it. He was like, "Hey, we're going to do this thing in place of a junket."
Yeah.
And it's just going to be kind of, would you be open to just coming and just like honestly just riffing on this idea of a guided meditation? I was like, oh yeah, sure, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's very funny.
Oh good, that's my whole thing, is anytime that the thing seems like it could be a setup for something funny to happen, I'm always happy to be there, you know, especially yeah. When it's Nick and Maya and me, that's easy.
At one point during that, I think it was Nick mentioned that you've become kind of a hermit during quarantine. Was that a joke, or was there some truth to that?
Oh, no, that's very true. I am being very conservative in this quarantine. I have really, for better or worse, I've erred on the side of being like a shut-in for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
You know, like I live alone, and I'm very, this is, you know, in a lot of ways, my personal worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pandemic specifically,
yeah,
is like, you know, it would be as if you had a crippling fear of flying and then we're in a plane crash. You know what I mean? Like, you know, my
because
actual...
Because you're a hypochondriac or because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think because I'm a hypochondriac, I think because for my whole life, like, health problems seem to have been woven into the fabric of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so I already feel susceptible to germs, colds, viruses, all this stuff. So I feel like, oh, well, now this is my whole thing. I'm, you know, this is the fucking worst. So for me, it really has been, I think, you know, to be quite honest, overcompensated and have really, like, I don't see people, you know, except for maybe very distanced, masked, you know, sitting in the backyard or something. But I haven't been to anybody's backyard dinner parties. I haven't been inside any stores or anything. I'm very rigid.
Do your friends think that you're overreacting or
whatever? Very much so.
Yeah.
And they're not wrong. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're not wrong. I will always counter and say, if everybody did what I'm doing for 6 weeks,
this thing would be gone. Yeah.
This thing would be so close to gone. Yeah. It would be crazy. If everybody just did what I'm doing, more specifically, if everybody did what I'm doing in March,
yeah,
we really wouldn't be where we are right now. We wouldn't be having, we're recording this, December 8th. We're having 2,000 to 3,000 people a day die of this.
I know.
And that is, these are the numbers that were preventable.
Yeah.
We're now past the threshold. If we'd responded appropriately at the beginning, this is what this podcast is about, right?
Right. Yeah, totally.
This is pandemic talk, right? With Matt?
Exactly.
So the bummer is I'm still acting like, oh, if I just do this for a little while, we're going to get through it. And the rest of the country is like, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
We want chaos.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, you're lucky that a lot of the work that you do is you're able to do from home, including recording voiceover for animation like Big Mouth.
Yeah.
I'm such a big fan of the show and really, really enjoyed this new season a lot. Watched it, of course, way too fast when it came out, which I think is what most fans of the show do.
I love that. I love that Big Mouth is a show that people don't let linger.
No, it's like impossible.
Yeah, everybody seems to just burn through it. And that's awesome because that's how I feel about my favorite shows.
Yeah. So with Big Mouth, was this season already finished basically when the quarantine happened? But you've been working on future seasons in the meantime?
Yeah, exactly. So we had already recorded season 4 and it was out to animation when the quarantine hit or when COVID hit. But we were in the process of doing season 5. So the real change is in the writer's room, and also in our recording setups we're almost all of season 5. And then some little bits of season 4, just like little ADR lines here or there.
And things.
Exactly.
In the before times, would you record with the people that you're in the scene with a lot?
For the most part.
Some animation does that and some doesn't.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about Big Mouth that's great is it primarily is a group of friends, Nick and Andrew and Mark and Jen really wonderfully cast like people who all have not just known each other for a long time, but have worked together many times in different iterations. So there is a lot, and a lot of people have a pretty strong improv background.
Yeah.
So it is not uncommon, to get me, Nick, and Jesse in a studio together if we have the scene together or whatever iteration of people necessary. So that we can open it up and find new paths to a joke, new jokes. We can play around and be a little bit messier. If you do it one by one, you really are, for better or worse, stuck in the script. You can't dynamically alter something in the moment. You have to be like, oh, I have a pitch on this, but it's going to require you to then, when you record with this person, remember to change their line to this so that my new line makes sense.
Yeah, and if they already recorded, then they have to go back.
Exactly. So it's a bit, it can be more of a headache. And Big Mouth is a looser, kind of shaggier show in that way. It's very joke dense, which is wonderful. And a lot of that comes from the kind of numerous cumulative processes that go into the making of a Big Mouth episode, from the writer's room to a table read to recording sessions to each iteration of the animation we receive back animatic to, there's like there's a radio play, there's an animatic, there's like multiple stages. At each stage you can go back in and tinker, as opposed to live action, which you really don't have that many opportunities to tinker. So it's great. We're really given a lot of freedom and latitude to make scenes or jokes or beats work as best as possible.
In season 4, so many of your scenes are with Lola, who's of course played by Nick.
Yeah.
And I love that your new dynamic with Lola.
Oh, Lola and Jay.
What are those scenes like to record with Nick?
Oh, so fun. So funny. Those were hilarious. I mean, like, I'm sure somebody recorded stuff, like video recorded stuff at some point.
Yeah.
But just Nick and I in a booth just doing Lola and Jay sex scenes, just crying, laughing, like all the fingering stuff, everything, you know, it's always fun. You know, we've been performing together for, you know, so long. So it really is a delight to get to do stuff with him. And the Lola and Jay storyline, the romance of it, because they're also like, I really loved that story because it really gave these two broken, lonely, misfit, melancholy kids like a partner. You know, it gave them a teammate, someone they felt seen by, because they're both the person in their friend group who is constantly being dismissed, you know, or not thought of or not invited along or whatever. And so that they could find not just each other, but that they could find, especially in like the Lola and Jay, the Halloween episode, rather, with the Serge Gainsbourg, Bonnie and Clyde song. It's so great that they are like, they can find a way to, even though they're not able to participate, like they can have their own like incredible time. It ends heartbreakingly, yes, but I don't know. I loved that storyline. It made me really happy for Jay, you know, because it's so weird, but I'm very fond of Jay, you know, like I'm very fond of him and feel very sad for him at times. So very happy that he found Lola.
I must admit, Jay, that a life of crime, personally speaking, has made me ravenous.
Oh, yeah. Hey, babe, you ever think pancakes are sexy little beds for mice to, like, fuck on?
Oh, my God, all the time. And the butter is obviously their pillows.
Oh, my God, totally, babe. Sexy little pillows that they just sleep on?
We're on the same page. That's nice.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Totally. Hey, Lola.
Yes, Jay?
I love you.
Aw, thanks, Jay. You're cool, too.
Is there anything else you want to say, like, back to me?
Maybe the boysenberry syrup is their lube?
What?
For the mice who fuck on the pancake beds, doy.
Oh, sure, yeah. Will you excuse me for a sec? Suddenly my face is red, and I'm mad at the world, and I want it to end.
Okay, I'm gonna order coffee as a joke.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really funny.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a great journey in these seasons so far. I mean, I think he's changed a lot, too, and sort of become more complex, which is not maybe what people expected or that you even expected when you first started doing this show. So has that been surprising for you to kind of see where they take the character?
Oh, yeah. Every season, you know, usually Nick and I will hike frequently here in normal times. And as they start the writer's room up, or maybe a little bit beforehand as they're starting to have conversations, he will kind of be like, oh, you know what we're starting to think about, or what somebody suggested was. And so I'll start hearing percolations of ideas for Jay or for stories or for whatever. And so it's always exciting to be on those hikes and hear like him being like, we're considering that Jay will become bisexual this season, though he will realize his bisexuality. And I was like, I love that. This is incredible. You know, like that you're going to take this kid who is this horny little monster and you're going to really open him up, because he was so, in those early seasons, so clearly focused on just like pounding out that pillow, you know,
and a lot of pillow action.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to really kind of open him up and to really kind of give him a broader perspective on himself, and because he's also deeply unself-aware. So to track Jay's journey into becoming more self-aware and becoming more, you know, in touch with or aware of his emotions rather than just careening between, you know, hyperbolic reactions to things, you know, has been really fun and wonderful.
I know a lot of the storylines in the show come from the writers' actual lives or stories that they heard or people from them growing up. Is there anything from your adolescence that's made it into the show?
Trying to think, not entirely. Jay is based on, like, most of the characters. Jay, as well as Jesse, and obviously Nick and Andrew, are based on a group of friends that Nick and Andrew Goldberg grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am based, I think, on two of their friends, one of whom did close-up magic, and I think one of whom fucked the pillow. I think that's the right separation. So a lot of those kind of formative components of Jay are not based on me. It's not based on, like, my childhood, nor was I raised, like, in a feral atmosphere or anything like that. But I certainly knew a lot of kids who lived Jay's life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I said early on in one of those things, I was like, I feel like Jay's one of those kids that I knew whenever you went over to their house, like, the kid was never wearing a shirt. they were just like a shirt-free house, and that has found its way into Jay. Jay is, whenever he's home, he's wearing cutoffs and no shirt. Doesn't matter.
You know, you mentioned that you've known Nick for so long and have worked with him in so many different ways. When did you actually meet Nick, and what were your sort of first impressions of him?
I'm trying to think. I don't know when I first met him. It was certainly in the UCB / New York comedy scene of the early 2000s. I'm like a step older than Nick, so I got to New York in the late 90s. Nick got to New York a little late in the early 2000s. And then he was around. He was a stand-up. He went through the UCB system, but he was also one of the young stand-ups who was kind of doing shows at Rififi, and they were like, you know, that whole crew was around. So I'd met him, certainly, but we started becoming friendly. We were both in LA during pilot season one year.
Oh, yeah.
When very few people were. We still lived in New York, but we're in L.A. for pilot season. And we hung out a couple of times in L.A. Maybe those weren't our first actual hangouts, but those were the first, like, meaningful hangouts where we, like, I feel like was the beginning of us being friends, not just kind of comedy acquaintances, in other words.
Were you going on a lot of auditions during that pilot season?
Yeah, like, for example, like, Nick and I were both in the waiting room for Cavemen.
Yeah.
We auditioned for Cavemen at the same time, you know? He got it. I did not, thankfully.
Yeah. How did you feel about that at the time versus how do you feel about it now?
Oh, I felt fine about it at the time because it seemed, even at the time, I was like, and it proved true. Like, I was like, I don't know. That seems like a tremendous amount of, like, like prosthetics and makeup, which seemed to me to be like, it's going to be hard to be funny inside of that, you know? And it seems like that is the case. Like, it seemed like it was very difficult just on a practical level, you know?
Yeah.
4 hours of makeup every morning and like 2 hours to take it off or something like that. Tough.
Did you feel like you came close to getting things and didn't get them, or it's like you didn't even come close?
The first year, I didn't even come close. You know, the first year, I didn't come close to, I don't think, anything.
Yeah.
I think the second year, I think I tested for one show. And a test is like when it's down to, like, you know, you and a handful of other people. Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, we saw 60 people for this role, we've winnowed that down now to these four people. And I think I tested for one show that second year, didn't get it. The next year, I don't think I tested for anything again. Like, it was like there was a lot of dry years, but a lot of dry years where I was in some ways getting acclimated to how the system worked and was acclimating casting directors to who I was and what I did. So that there came a point when people, I think, started to figure out, like, oh, you know, this, I understand now who Jason Manzoukas, the actor, is. I think he would be right for these parts, because a lot of times I would be auditioning for parts that I wasn't necessarily right for.
Yeah.
But would nonetheless be in the mix.
Coming up, the part that changed everything for Jason and why he's struggled to break out of that mold ever since.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like from looking at your career that you really forged your own, you know, parts that you're right for, and that people maybe started writing parts that were Jason Mantzoukas kind of parts. I mean, when did you feel that start to happen?
Like when I auditioned, I would say like the show that really was a pivot point for me, or a tipping point in a Malcolm Gladwellian way, is The League, obviously, is for the most part when people first really saw me, you know, even though I'd been on stuff here and there. Really, The League was, I feel like, for the most part, when people really saw, like, for most people, that's the first time they clocked me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because I did not get the part that I auditioned for, which was Andre, which was Paul Scheer's part.
Oh, yeah.
So in the final set of auditions for The League, I was auditioning for Andre. I had also auditioned for Pete, Mark Duplass's part. I didn't get it, right? Those guys all got it, and they made season one. But the Schaefers, who created the show, really liked me. And because the show is improvised, they wanted improvisers. And so they were like, we want you to come in season two just to play this character. We don't have the character yet, but we have the plot. We know what the story is. The story is you're Nick's brother-in-law. He wants to have you join the league so that he can look good to his wife. And that will own him, that will get him wife points. But the league guys are going to hate him. And then it'll go on for like two episodes. And then in the third episode, they're going to kick you out.
And that was supposed to be it.
That was supposed to be it. And so then they were like, what version of that are you interested in? You know, like, how do you want to do that? And so in a lot of ways, like, I would say I am known for playing a lot of, you know, kind of crazy, maniac, wild-eyed characters. And that is because a lot of people first saw me on this show, because I said to them, I was like, the role you, it's a great ensemble, but the role you don't have is a maniac.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you don't have. So I happened to play a very good maniac. I'd been playing a version of Rafi in one of the sketch shows St. Clair and I did. I'd been playing that type of a guy for a while. So I was like, yeah. I can come in at this. I was like, I would like to come into your show as unbridled id. Like a man who is just consuming anything and everything in his path, you know? And they were like, great, let's do it. And so for me, that was like a real moment, because people saw that role, I feel like, and then were like, almost immediately, I started getting more work as an actor in similarly unhinged performances, you know, or wild or weird or whatever, you know, like that's how I get to be on Modern Family, or that's how I get to be on all of these other shows at the time, is because people saw me on The League and were like, oh, I can play with that flavor, or that song, or whatever. I can that would complement my show too, you know.
Was there any double-edged sword nature to that, in the sense that you're getting stuck in that type, or that only getting to play one thing?
Absolutely, for sure. And you know, and definitely there are roles that I did or took in order to kind of deviate from that, you know, like, or things that I think were like my role in The Dictator is like the straight man. Sasha is the wild, outrageous kind of character who can't control his appetites. And I am the person who is constantly trying to ground him, you know, and make him see reality. I'm the voice of reason in that movie. So there's stuff that I've done, certainly, that attempts to get away from that. But I also, there is, I mean, like Jay on Big Mouth, like there is real joy for me in playing characters who have no governors or who have no limits or who have no, you know, filters. You know, like there's something wonderful about playing characters who can just exercise their emotions, their vulnerabilities, their feelings at any point in time, you know?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about The Dictator, mostly just because I'm fascinated by Sacha Baron Cohen.
Sure.
And everything that he does. And so I'm curious what it was like to work with him in that project that's like not a typical project for him, and that it was a much more scripted comedy where he's, you know, not interacting with real people, but I'm sure also had some elements of his, you know, unique genius in there as well. So what was that like for you to work so closely with him?
It was pretty incredible, actually. You know, especially even though I'd been doing comedy for a long time, it was still one of my early jobs. You know, it was like really jobs of significant weight, you know, like I'm in a lot of that movie, you know?
Yeah, it was a big deal.
Exactly. To me at the time, it was a huge opportunity and an incredible deal because I was somebody who, you know, when Sacha was doing the Ollie G show in the UK, somebody on our improv team used to have videos sent from the UK to us so we could watch. Like, not just Sacha, but we watched Ollie G, we watched all the Chris Morris shows, Brass Eye, Day Today, Nathan Barley, you know, all the early Charlie Brooker stuff, all of the, you know, Snuffbox, the, you know, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. We were obsessed with British comedy. So I was already, like, deep in on Sacha, you know, and thought he was a genius. So to work with somebody that I so looked up to and revered in a job that was, you know, fairly early on in my career was really incredible opportunity. Like to be, because there's a lot of that movie that's just he and I.
Yeah.
And Burke Schaefer Mandel wrote it, who were, you know, such a powerhouse writing team. Jeff Schaefer created The League. Alec Berg helped create Silicon Valley and Barry. Dave Mandel took over and finished the last seasons of Veep. Like, these are, like, the heaviest of heavy hitters.
Serious writers, yeah.
And not just that. Like, on set on any given day, there would also be Peter Bainham, Dan Mazur, Ant Hines, all of these incredible British writers that Sacha had come up with in the UK. So there was like, you know, Adam McKay was there. You know, there was, we did a table read for that movie. This blew my mind. We did a table read for that movie before it was fully cast, just to kind of read it out loud and kind of get notes. And the people giving notes were like, you know, it was Gary Shandling and Larry David and Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. And like, it was like the heaviest of heavy hitters.
That's wild.
In the crowd. And I was like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
This is really exciting. It was.
Was that nerve wracking to perform for all those people?
You know, weirdly, it wasn't. I felt pretty confident. I'm a pretty confident person.
Yeah.
So I felt pretty confident. And Sacha and I had already been working together. So I felt pretty good in our dynamic. So it was actually just a blast. Really fun. And so working with him was kind of incredible, you know, to watch on a process level, to work on that scale and scope was enormous. Like, I'd never worked on something that was that big and expensive. And we would spend whole days shooting just one scene, you know, which I'd never experienced before. You know, The League, we would shoot like 13 pages a day or something, the equivalent thereof. And we're sitting here, you know, getting like a page a day. Like, it was really fascinating and interesting and super educational. And, you know, just to get to work with him, Larry Charles, the director, was great. Larry Scher, the DP, was great. Joe Reedy. I mean, like, it was like everybody, like the first AD was like the first, these Scorsese's and the Coen brothers first AD. It was like mental, you know?
Ah, Nadal! We are just months away from refining weapons-grade uranium, and we are set to test the missile next week.
It is too round on the top. It needs to be pointy. Round is not scary. Pointy is scary. This will put a smile on the faces of the enemy. They will think that it is a huge robot's dildo flying towards them.
No, Supreme Leader, the shape of the missile top has nothing to do with aerodynamics. It is about the payload delivery.
No, it sticks in the ground, and then kaboom. Supreme Leader, I think perhaps some of your information about bombs is coming from cartoons.
Nonsense. I have been watching research films.
In this film, just one question, was there a duck who, when the explosion happens, his bill goes around the back of his head, and then in order to talk, he has to put it back this way?
There was somebody who suffered a deformity like that, yeah.
Okay. I am now 100% sure that you are watching cartoons.
One thing that occurred to me with the dictator, and I think this is something you've maybe talked about before, is that you've played a lot of different ethnicities in your career, and sort of in that one especially, and then other things as well. And that's something that's come up in the conversation around the new season of Big Mouth with the Missy character and Jenny Slate's decision to, you know, stop playing that character who's mixed race. And I'm just curious if that discussion, because I know you've probably had to talk about it, and people, did it make you think at all about your own choices in your career and sort of what you, if you would do anything differently or moving forward or any of that?
It's such an interesting conversation right now. Yeah, you know, I've played a lot of other ethnicities, mostly because people will only cast me as other ethnicities. yeah. I'm in this weird middle ground where I won't be considered for the white lead role. Mm-hmm. I had a casting director sit me down once and say, hey, this was before I was really having any success. She said, hey, I just want to tell you something just so I don't want you to be discouraged. She was like, you're not going to work for a while because people don't know what to make of you. You are, and I'm paraphrasing now, but she basically said, you're not handsome enough to be the lead, but you're too handsome to be his schlubby friend. And you're not white enough to be the lead, but you're also not an actual ethnicity to be cast as a diversity hire. So she's like, you're not going to get hired anywhere. You're not like, you're going to fall through all the cracks. Like you can't, you don't check any box. You don't make any sense, right? Really, right? Mm-hmm. She's like, but you're very talented. You're very funny. So I want you to like, know you're going to work. It's just going to take people kind of bending something to fit you, and it's going to take a while. And it did. That was like, it took years after that before I started working. And a lot of it is because this, I don't appear to be what people consider as a traditional white guy role, right? I don't look like that. What I look like is a traditional diversity hire role, but I am in fact not that. So I'm,
yeah, it's complicated.
This is where we get into a whole conversation about race and what what all this means. That's a very strange and uncomfortable conversation to be having. But yeah, I mean, like that role in The Dictator, should that role have been played by somebody? You know, listen, it's a country that's not real. It's a fake Middle Eastern country. Should my role have been played by someone of Middle Eastern descent? Probably.
Yeah, but if you're going to say that, then you have to say the same thing about, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen, yeah.
Of course. So that's kind of the, once you start pulling the string of that sweater, at a certain point, The Dictator just can't be made, you know, in the way it's envisioned as a vehicle for Sacha Baron Cohen, you know, and his particular brand of humor. You could certainly write a movie, you know, in that world, but it's not a Sacha Baron Cohen movie, if that makes sense.
I've been very impressed. This is sort of related that you've been able to keep your beard going for so long in so many different roles. And is that something that you've run into where people try to get you to shave it, or is it at this point it's like comes part of the package? No question.
It's the opposite. Like there's been a bunch of roles where I've said, hey, if you want me to shave, if you want me to shave it different, if you want me to do, you know, if you want me to just let me know. You know, and almost everybody says, oh, no, stay that, keep it there. And, you know, a couple of people have been like, can we trim it to like a more, you know, in like sleeping with other people, or there's a couple of other roles where I'm like a little bit more straight laced. Mm-hmm. But no, it really is weird. I'm not, I like having the beard, but I'm also fully open to shaving it, doing it differently, whatever I think is good for a character, or whatever someone on the creative side thinks would be good. If they wanted me to have a mustache, or you know, or have no facial hair at all, I'm fully open to it.
Yeah, I like that it's become a brand to the point where Adult Jay in the future episode has your beard.
I know. It's so weird.
Did you
right?
like that when you saw that for the first time?
Of course. I loved it. I was nothing made me happier.
Yeah, that's a great episode too. So I want to, if we can, just because you've been in so many things that I love, just run through a few more of them. And if there's sort of a memory or story that comes to mind, if not, no problem. But if there is, that we could talk about. And one of the first is some going way back is Enlightened, which was,
oh, yeah.
I think, one of your first, was it your first regular role on TV, sort of, or was it?
That and The League, I booked in the same period, and they were both recurring roles.
Yeah.
So they were both, like, they were both, you know, I can't remember what it was, but they were both roles that I was in, like, you know, 3 to 5 episodes a season of.
Yeah.
And loved, because I was such a fan of Mike White's, such a fan of Laura Dern's. They had brought on, from the pilot to the series, they'd brought on Miguel Arteta to be the series director, along with other incredible directors. Like, that was a case where working on Enlightened was like, oh, I'm getting to be directed by Jonathan Demme. I'm getting to be directed by Miguel Arteta. I'm getting to be
like a little indie film every week.
Really, and it was incredible. You know, like the way the juxtaposition between shooting The League, which was real run and gun, fully improvised chaos,
yeah,
to, you know, I'd be on set of Enlightened a couple of weeks later, and it was the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. It was very precise and very, you know, word perfect and very big camera moves, big setting up, big dolly shots, stuff that we just never did on The League. So that really, the doing both of those shows in that same time frame actually was hugely educational for me in terms of two different ways you can make wonderful television.
Mm-hmm. The next one is Transparent, which you kind of popped in certain episodes and later in the seasons. What was your experience like on that show?
I loved it. It was great. You know, I'd known that they were making it. I knew some of the folks on it. And I was so impressed by what they, you know, because I knew Jay Duplass. And I was just in hearing what they were doing, I was like, this is going to be fucking, because this was always also the beginning of Amazon. Mm-hmm. This was the beginning of really streaming stuff,
yeah,
right? These were early days. So it was really, I was so intrigued and curious. And so to be brought into it was very exciting. And then I had that wonderful thing happen where my part, very small, very kind of transactional.
Mm-hmm.
But because they let me improvise, because they opened it up, and because they let us improvise, we found such a funny, flirtatious dynamic between Amy Landecker and myself.
Yeah.
That when we were done with just our little scene, they were like, well, I guess you guys, yeah, I guess you'll have to come back next season. You know, I guess you'll have to return so you guys can hook up, you know? And then luckily they made that happen,
yeah,
you know? So that was that's a wonderful example of like how the process allows for kind of something set to be kind of blossom into something even more rewarding, you know?
Yeah. Did you lean into the flirting at all to make that happen, or did that just happen naturally?
It just happened organically. I didn't know Amy Landecker, I didn't know personally.
Mm-hmm.
So we had just met and we're just chatting, she, Jay, and I.
Yeah.
And it was just fun. And because I felt very comfortable around Jay because I'd known him for years. So it was, I wonder if I had gone onto that set knowing nobody, I probably would have been more conservative. I probably would have just done the lines as they were.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing much else would have happened. I would have appeared in that episode of Transparent. But I think because I knew the creators and some of the people behind the scenes, and because I knew Jay pretty well, I felt very comfortable in being loose and fun. And so improvising, once they said they were okay with that, it was very easy to kind of mix it up and mix it up with Jay, and then starting with Amy, and Amy being very excited and game to improvise, and it just fell into like a fun, flirty banter, and that became the hook of what would then kind of recur the rest of the time.
Oh, let's see what we got here. Let's get down to brass tacks. What do you think is the worst out of these things, because you checked a bunch? Anxiety, irritable bowel syndrome, really? For such a pretty lady, Such an upset
it's
tummy.
It's sort of hard to say. Like this weekend, I don't have my kids for the first time, like ever in their whole lives, because I had this recent separation and it's kind of, but it's like, I don't really feel that. But I don't know, like, I guess I'm like really revved up during the day. And then when I try to sleep at night, I can't get to sleep. But it being so funny, like I am the happiest I've ever been in my life. So this like totally doesn't make sense.
And you seem very anxious.
I do.
Yeah. I mean, sexy, but anxious.
Oh, thank you.
So I have to ask you about I'm Sorry.
Sure.
Because one, it's one of my wife's favorite shows, and she told me that I have to ask you about it.
Of course.
I also
it's amazing.
Love it as well.
It's heartbreaking.
Also, Andrea Savage was our first guest of this year.
Oh, cool.
And I believe you will be our last guest of this
Bookends.
Year.
Bookends.
So there you go. Yeah. And you guys are great in the show together.
Oh, thank you.
So yeah. Well, how'd you end up on that show, you know, in that sort of a relationship with her? Yeah. What's going on with the show?
Well, the show has been canceled by True TV. Heartbreakingly. So they were
that
ready.
Is heartbreaking.
Yeah. They were ready to go into season 3. They were all geared up.
Yeah, I think when I talked to her, she was in the writer's room and like things were happening.
They had scripts going. They were gearing up towards production just as COVID shut everything down.
Yeah.
Within the 9 months of shutdown, it is one of the many shows that has been canceled as a result.
There are so many. It's really a bummer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a real bummer. It's similar to how we're talking about a lot of these shows or a lot of these kind of things. It is trading on pre-existing friendships, really. Andrea Savage and I have known each other for years. We played husband and wife and Sleeping with Other People.
Right, yeah.
We've done other shows. We've done live shows together, like comedy live shows on stage. So, and we are also like part of a friend group that went on vacations together, that spent a lot of time together. So we already had that banter dynamic that is... Mm-hmm. In the show, that was our dynamic, you know, sort of, you know. And so when she started putting her show together, she was like, hey, I've got this part that's a writer, my writing partner, that can kind of just pop in and out if you have free time. And so in a great way, when she was gearing up to do season 1, I had a bunch of free time. So they wrote a bunch of those scenes for us. We got to do a bunch of stuff. And then in season 2, during the time they were doing that, I was fully booked on something else. And so it was like, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this.
You got replaced by Scott Aukerman.
Exactly. So it was really lucky because, and this is, again, this Big Mouth operates in a very similar way. A lot of these shows operate similarly in that we're all part of a larger friend group. And it's kind of like, can you grab people when you can grab them, get them on your show for a little while to do something, and then they're going to ask you to do the same at some point. Someday I'll have my show and I will have Savage come on my show, you know, or whatever. You know, like everybody, I feel like, I don't want to just label it as UCB because it's not UCB. Savage came up in the Groundlings, you know, but the general improv sketch community, I would say, mm-hmm. in New York and LA, is very supportive, very, very supportive, very, very support-minded in terms of helping everybody make everything as good as possible, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And then another one that I have to ask you about, because I think the fans of it would freak out if I didn't, is The Good Place.
Yeah.
That was sort of a departure from your typical part that you play.
Yeah. Like a true innocent. Yeah.
Yeah. As opposed to a dirtbag. Yeah. Monster.
Not a scumbag at all. A weirdo for sure, but not a scumbag. Yeah. Yeah.
Was that fun to kind of do something different in that sense?
Oh my God, so fun. Incredible. And also one of the best things that when it happens is when I get to be a part of something I'm already a fan of.
Yeah, it must be very strange.
Yeah. I'd already seen season 1 of The Good Place. I watched it when it aired. I loved it. Thought it was great. And then I started hearing rumblings that there was a character they were working on that they were thinking about me for, kind of just like loose kind of rumors. Oh, I was in a hotel somewhere working on something, and Mike Schur called me and pitched me the character. And the character was so crazy when he pitched it, because he was like, hey, I've got an idea that I want to pitch you for this character. And I was like, yeah, whatever you want, I'm going to do it. So, yes, the answer is yes, but please pitch it to me. And then he pitched me this character, which was Derek, you know, and you might know this, or I've said this before, but the character's dialogue would be written, it would be Google translated into like Romanian.
Yeah.
The Romanian would be translated into like something else, like Cantonese. And then the Cantonese would be retranslated back into English. And those would be my lines. So my lines had the tone or the tenor of meaning, but not, they didn't mean anything. They were, you know, gibberish for the most part.
That seems like it would be hard to memorize.
It turns out very hard to memorize. Very hard to memorize, because it was very difficult to be like, okay, I'm going to decide that this is the verb and this is where, okay, this is how I'm going to try and construct this for meaning, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he pitched it to me, and I was like, everything about what you're saying sounds incredible. And the fact that I was going to get to do all my stuff with Darcy Carden, who, again, I've known for 15 years from UCB back in New York, I was like, absolutely, this is going to be a blast, you know? And so doing Derek, and then what I didn't know was that every season, Derek would be upgraded. You know, so when I got the first script for the next season and Derek is suave Derek in a tuxedo, I was like, whatever this is, I'm on board 100%.
New thing. Yeah.
You must be Michael. Janet's made a lot of talk into my ear holes about you. Michael, Kleichel.
Janet, you can't make a person.
I know, but I did, though. Eleanor said that to forget about Jason, I should create a rebound guy.
Derek.
So I made one. Hi. Derek.
Oh, I'm her boyfriend, and she made me.
He's so nice.
Whoa! Look at this glass! Oh, my God! I'm in there, too? What's going on right now?
So kind of just looking forward, you know, I know your work has been limited this year to, you know, podcasts and animation and things. I really loved The Long Dumb Road, which was, you know, this big leading role that you did in a movie, which is, you know, I think the only time you've done that. I would imagine that experience made you want to do more stuff like that. How are you sort of looking ahead to, you know, when you are able to work again, what kind of stuff you want to do? Is that the kind of thing that you're hoping to do more of?
You know, absolutely. I had such an amazing experience making that movie. The co-writer and director, Hannah Fidel, Tony Revolori, and myself in Albuquerque, New Mexico, making that movie was really a kind of incredible experience. And it also happens to be the kind of movie I personally love. Like, I love a shaggy hangout, road trip, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Midnight Run kind of movie. You know, like it both was an opportunity to be the lead of a movie, which I was very happy to be given the opportunity to do. But it also was just like a great movie, a wonderfully written movie, a beautifully directed movie, and with people that I loved, like Tony Revolori, you know, Grace Gummer, Thaisa Farmiga, like really Ron Livingston. They got great people. Casey Wilson, incredible. Really fun. And I'm a sucker for, like, I grew up in the era of Sundance, like, indie film movement. You know, Jim Jarmusch, Nicole Hall of Center, Soderbergh, Tom DiCillo, like, all those kind of, like, 80s era John Sayles indie film movement, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so to participate in that, like, to be able to, like, make a movie that I felt like was in that, you know, a small, intimate, but very character-driven movie that did go to Sundance was really exciting to me. And I'd love to continue to do stuff like that. I'd love to continue to dig in on lead roles, complicated characters like that character was. I'd love that. I loved it on a process level, and I loved the movie that resulted from it. You know, I had a great experience, and yeah, I would love to do more stuff like that. And, you know, but I will say too, I also loved getting to be in John Wick 3, you know, which was, you know, a whole different thing. Like, one of the things that I really enjoy and I'm very grateful for is that I get to kind of do a bunch of different stuff, you know, that I get to exercise a bunch of different muscle, both as an actor, doing different types of roles in different types of situations, whether it's a network show like The Good Place or a cable show like The League or something like that, or whether it's, you know, a small indie movie like Long Dumb Road or a big blockbuster thing like, you know, I just shot this movie called Infinite in last year in London. That's like a big sci-fi, you know, epic kind of crazy movie. And then I also get to, like, get on stage with my friends and do like our podcast or do live shows. And all of it kind of to me is the career.
Yeah. No, it's incredible, really. When you look at it all on paper, it's like the amount of stuff that you've been able to do and different things and things that people love. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, I love all the stuff that is easy to find. And then also like the little things that I really get a kick out of, like the two episodes of the Chris Gethard show that Shear and I guested yeah. on, or, you know, me and Brian Husky and Rob Corddry and Jesse Falcon have made two really weird, surreal Adult Swim specials, Mr. Neighbor's House, which are out there that are, I'm also super proud of, but are, you know, things that were aired at like 3 o'clock in the morning on Adult Swim. So again, there's something kind of cool about right now that a lot is possible, you know, a lot yeah. of anything from little weird projects to giant potential blockbusters. I'm glad that I'm able to kind of try and have access to all of them.
Are there things on the books for next year that are sort of like tentatively happening or things that are?
There aren't really. Like I will say there were mm-hmm. things that have all been canceled or pushed or are question mm-hmm. marks. So
yeah.
Honestly, we'll see. I mean, I think that, you know, and now that there is some light at the end of the tunnel and we understand that there will be vaccines and it will roll out and we're going to be in a different, this time next year is going to look a lot different than right now. We're going to see things start getting back up and running. I've been offered things that I've said no to just because I don't feel safe on a set.
Yeah.
But no. So right now I don't have anything, you know, that I'm looking forward to, like I'm going to be on set, you know, January 10th or something like that.
Yeah. So far, you'll just be at home.
So far, I'm in the closet. I'm talking to people. I have recorded a ton of really cool, really fun. There are projects that are coming out next year that are almost all animated.
Yeah. I think there's going to be a lot of animation coming out next year, huh?
Oh, yeah. I don't think I can talk about them yet because I don't think they've been announced, but some of them are mm-hmm. fucking super cool.
Yeah. That's fun to do. Just do secret animation projects in
your
house.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. You know, it's really weird to be like, you know, to go to work. Really, when I'm done, click off the computer and walk out of my closet and I'm just in my house.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre, but
it's a new life.
So there is a bunch of fun stuff coming out, but it's all in that space right now.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to find out what some of that stuff is.
Oh, yeah.
So we end every episode of the podcast by talking about a time when a guest has really laughed very hard in their life. And so I'm curious for you. Is there a time that you can think of on set, and you've been on so many hilarious sets, when you really just couldn't stop laughing?
Yes, and it's on camera. It's on YouTube, I think, somewhere, because it was in the gag reel for The League. I don't know what season, but it's the scene in which it's the Scrote Squad episode where I'm punching everybody in the balls. It's Kroll and I. It's almost always Kroll and I, because I can make Kroll break so easily. It's like I can just get him. But mm-hmm. oftentimes the result of that is then I break as well. And it's a scene in which he's asking me to protect his balls while simultaneously going after everybody else. So I say, I will protect your balls. I'll be your ballsy guard. Your balls will be Whitney and I am Kevin Costner. And he says, RIP. And then I have an incredibly large reaction to the death of Whitney Houston, which Rafi did not know about. And then what then happens is, because it's all improvised, right? So I'm improvising all of these lines. So everything is a discovery to Nick. So we start breaking immediately upon this realization that I don't know Whitney's dead. We then cannot shoot this scene. It's the last scene of the day. It should be super quick to bang out. We're just sitting in chairs. There's no camera moves. It's nothing. It's so simple. We get laughing so hard that Nick has to leave the room. I have to do lines alone. We start to yell at each other. They actually cut it into the gag reel as the footage. And it's that is a time when it was so funny to us. What we were doing was so funny. It was also like, there's something about end of the day punchiness, which leads to really just losing it. But that was definitely an onset where laughter was like really made it probably take like twice as long to shoot that scene.
Okay, ready? Right in. What? Oh my God, oh no. Whitney's dead? I need to be able to look at you, man. Okay, I'm not gonna look at you, so that at least there's a single of me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. What? Oh my God, oh no! Oh, Whitney's dead? Oh no.
I just don't know, it's just Friday, it's so tired. Okay,
ready? Here we go, and we're in it, and what? What? Oh my God. Oh no, Whitney's dead? Oh, how's Michael Jackson taking it? No, you gotta stop. You gotta stop.
That's great. Yeah, that's a classic scene.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. That show, because that show was improvised, there was a lot of really funny stuff that would make us laugh and break because it was discovery, because nobody knew what was coming because there was no script. So it really was just, you would say something and you can watch The League now and you can watch me say lines and just look at other people.
Yeah. Just to see look in their eyes.
And Nick is visibly laughing in the scene in which I'm saying, sometimes I throw up when I come and sometimes I come, whatever. That whole line about the vanilla candle, sometimes, yeah. He's in the background, he is visibly just laughing. It's really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so great. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah. Did we get through it all?
I think we did. I think we did it.
All right. Did I sound cogent and thoughtful about all your questions?
Totally.
All right. Great.
I think so. Yeah. It's a great, great last new episode of the year.
Well, congratulations on getting through the year.
Okay. Thanks so much to Jason Mantzoukas. That was a blast. If you haven't burned through it already like me, season 4 of Big Mouth is available to stream on Netflix now. I also highly recommend The Long Dumb Road, which is also on Netflix. And you can subscribe to the hilarious podcast Jason hosts with Paul Scheer and June Diane Raphael, How Did This Get Made, wherever you get your podcasts. Oh, and I mentioned to Jason that this is our last new episode of the year, but we do have something very special coming your way next week, so please do look out for that as well. If you have enjoyed The Last Laugh this year, it would mean a ton to me if you could leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.